Support for the Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from you, our subscribers, and from
the Elm Street Group at Morgan Stanley, working with clients to create enduring financial value and a lasting impact through sustainable investing solutions, a local wealth management team with global insights. Find out more at the Elm Street Group at morganstanley.com.
And from Dartmouth Hitchcock, imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community. With convenient locations throughout northern New England, world-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more. Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. Increased attention and funding are coming to help the youngest victims of the opioid epidemic, newborn babies. These infants were exposed to drugs in the womb and suffer addiction withdrawal once born. One doctor at Dartmouth Hitchcock Medical Center estimates that 1 in 10 babies born at the hospital in Lebanon have been exposed to opioids. So now the medical center and other health providers around the state are jumping in to address this. It's tricky, though, because drug treatment for pregnant women and newborns involves some special health considerations. But some facilities are getting new resources from a charitable foundation grant and the federal government. This hour on The Exchange, pregnancy and the opioid crisis. Let's hear from you. Your questions and comments are welcome at 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. We have four guests on this topic. Courtney Gray Tanner is with us, Executive Director at Hope on Haven Hill, a substance use treatment organization for homeless, pregnant, and newly parenting moms in recovery. And Courtney Gray Tanner, nice to see you. Welcome back.
Thank you very much.
Also with us, Michelle Sperling, a new mom who is in recovery from opioid addiction with plans to become a recovery coach herself. Michelle was a resident at Hope on Haven Hill during her pregnancy. Her daughter, by the way, is now 5 months old. We saw her before the show. She's adorable. Michelle, thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you.
Also with us in studio, Michelle Merritt, Senior Vice President at New Futures, a nonprofit organization dedicated to improving the health and wellness of Granite Staters. And Michelle Merritt, good to meet you. Thank you for being here.
Thank you very much.
And joining us by phone is Dr. Allison Holmes. She's a pediatrician at the Children's Hospital at Dartmouth Hitchcock with a research focus on newborns exposed to opioids during pregnancy. And Dr. Holmes, thank you also for being with us. We really appreciate it.
It's great to be with you this morning.
Well, and before we talk to Michelle Sperling and Courtney Gray Tanner about their experiences working with these moms, Dr. Holmes, do you have a sense of just how big a problem this is in New Hampshire?
So the problem of newborns that have been exposed to opioids in pregnancy came here earlier, and the numbers are a little bit worse when we look at national data. This follows the issues with opioid prescriptions and rates of opioid dependence in general. So we are one of the hardest hit areas. The other area that has been particularly hard hit in the United States is the Ohio River Valley, so southern Ohio, Kentucky, Tennessee. So most of my research collaborators are either also from northern New England or from those states.
And that was your number that I quoted in my introduction, Dr. Holmes, that 1 in 10 babies born at your hospital in Lebanon have been exposed to opioids. I'm struck by that. That's a lot, Dr. Holmes.
It is a lot, and that's data from 2016 and 2017 is about what we're seeing. I think it's for a number of reasons. Statewide, it is about 6%. The last solid data we have from full state records, though, goes a few years back to around 2013, so it could potentially be higher across the state at this point. And then we here see a higher percentage of babies because many are referred to our center, where other smaller rural hospitals don't feel they necessarily have the resources to care for them.
Sure. And you have that expertise, too, which we'll talk about, the work you've been doing, the research you've been doing on this for sure. To you, too, Michelle Merritt. So Dr. Holmes told us about 6% of babies born in New Hampshire have exposure to opioids, 10% at her facility. What are you seeing in terms of the numbers or the trends?
So in just the last 10 years, we know that the number of babies who have been born experiencing withdrawal symptoms has tripled in the state of New Hampshire. It's it's very striking. If you look at data and trends, where we were 10 years ago compared to now, in 2015, which is the most recent year in which we had full state data, we had 227 infants born in the state of New Hampshire that were experiencing withdrawal symptoms. When you look back at the beginning of the early 2000s, those numbers were under 20. So it is a striking rise in the number of infants who have been born in this state experiencing these withdrawal symptoms.
So, Courtney, tell us about the women who come to you. Again, Hope on Haven Hill serves women who are in recovery from addiction. They're pregnant. How do they end up drug addicted? How do they feel about being addicted and pregnant?
Well, everyone has a different story. So Hope on Haven Hill serves homeless and imminently homeless, pregnant and postpartum women. So we're seeing women that come to us who have experienced chronic homelessness or are recently homeless because of their substance use disorders. And all of these women want to get better. They want to be good moms. And so that's why they're at Hope on Haven Hill. And once they are there, they're actively working on themselves to obtain their recovery and maintain their recovery and become really good moms.
I know that everybody has a different story, but do you hear similar themes time and time again about how people came to this place where they were addicted to opioids?
Yeah, well, I think we'll hear it in Michelle's story. But you know, nobody wants to be a person who's experiencing substance use disorders. Nobody chooses that path in life, and so unfortunately, when they're there, we're a safe place for them to go and get some help.
How long has Hope on Haven Hill been in operation?
On December 7th, we'll celebrate our 1-year anniversary. So, 10 months.
Yeah, and how many moms are there now?
We are an 8-bed facility, and so the house is always full.
And I've heard you had a waiting list.
We do have a wait list, yes.
Yeah, it makes me wonder if other organizations are going to start doing what you're doing. Mm-hmm. Michelle, we should hear your story too, and I'm so glad you were able to come in today. How much does that description that Courtney gave sound like you?
It sounds exactly like me. My addiction started with a little green pill. It was a Oxy 80, and I think that's actually what started this whole heroin epidemic. The pharmaceuticals realized it was, you know, an addictive drug after the fact and started taking it off the market, and addicts are gonna do anything they can to feel better. And the closest thing to that little green pill was heroin. And that's when it blew up. It's happened to people I would have never, ever thought in a million years would ever use. It doesn't discriminate whatsoever.
And I know this is really hard to talk about, so that's okay. Did you take the Oxy 80 for pain, or was it more just experimentation, Michelle? Or
I was actually at a party, and yeah. So I had never even heard of it, seen it, and somebody offered it to me. And I don't know why I did it. I smoked pot before that, but wasn't really a drinker. I wasn't really a partier. But for some reason, I snorted that little green pill, and the feeling I got, I can't even describe it. It's just from that moment, I was hooked.
Wow. It was that fast?
That fast. And I just constantly was chasing that first high.
So you got addicted to heroin.
I did. Once they took those off the market, the next best thing was heroin. And then heroin was really big for a while. And then I didn't even know it, but I had been doing fentanyl.
Which is pretty deadly. It's
yeah.
Impressive that you know, you're still here.
I'm grateful and very thankful to be alive right now. It's a scary, scary drug. And I never, ever in a million years thought that I'd be able to get sober. I would literally be crying, sticking a needle in my arm. I wanted it to just, I would pray to God, like, you know, please let me get better. I don't want to keep doing this. And I was a secret addict for a while. I was married. My ex-husband had no idea I was using. It was the second that I started using a needle. Within 3 months, I had lost my home, my marriage, my family, everything. I got a criminal record, but I'm actually grateful for my criminal record right now, because if I went down to Massachusetts and I actually got caught trafficking 50 grams of fentanyl, and at the time, I was very, very, like, upset about it, and I did some time in Framingham, Massachusetts, and...
That's the jail?
It is, the women's prison, and it, just that alone, I was petrified. I'd never been in trouble before, and here I am, trafficking charges, and from that moment, I detoxed in jail, and I'm very grateful now that it happened, because I don't think without that I would have ever been able to get sober. I had no access to my drug of choice. So when I got out of there, it was a new life for me. I'm like, I can either continue this or I can go back to the life I was living, which wasn't happening. And I actually found out I was pregnant along that same time. And what are the chances that I'm from Rochester, and right in my hometown, there's a treatment facility opening up for pregnant women. So it was just kind of my higher power. And I really believe that truly that God did this, like, put me on this path. And I'm so grateful for Hope on Haven Hill. They changed my life. Well, I changed my life, but they helped me on my journey so much. I had no one, no family, nothing. Homeless, pregnant, and they became my family. I've never had a bond with, the woman I lived with. I've never had a bond like that. We became like a sisterhood. We had dinner together every night. We went through this together, and I was pregnant. My roommate was pregnant.
Everybody's going through the same thing there.
Yeah, there was there's a few babies, and so I kind of got to watch motherhood before it actually happened to me, and I'm really grateful. I feel like I am a good mom. I think Hope on Haven Hill, taught me the skills that I needed to be who I am today, and I'm extremely proud of who I am today. I've come so far.
Well, it's an amazing story, and we'll untangle a little bit more of it as we go forward. But one thing you said speaks to, and I'll throw this to you, I think, Michelle Merritt, the power of these drugs. I mean, here, you know, Michelle Sperling told us she wasn't a big partier. You know, sounds like you were a good kid, if I could put it that way. And then she took one pill, and she just spent, you know, considerable time seeking the next high. I'm just really struck by that.
It's an experience that we hear every day as part of our work at New Futures. We work very closely with recovery communities and recovery community organizations. And as Courtney also mentioned, every individual's story is different, but addiction truly does not discriminate. And we find people's paths and their stories are varied and different, and it's a true testament to the experience that Michelle had articulated, that this happens all the time. It happens regardless of your income. It happens regardless of where you came from, your social background. It's an epidemic in this state, and it's one that fortunately now we're seeing increased state attention and investments that are being made. Our policymakers are paying attention to the issue. And so we're thankful for people like Michelle and sharing their stories and how this has really affected them, because that's really what truly moves the needle on a lot of these issues.
The number for you to join our conversation today is 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Again, 1-800-892-6477. Today in The Exchange, pregnancy and opioid addiction. There's new attention and new resources aimed at helping expectant moms and their babies, given rising numbers of infants born with addiction. You can join us again, 1-800-892-6477. Dr. Holmes, to you, how likely is it that a woman who's abusing substances, opioids or alcohol or other drugs, will have a baby who is likewise addicted? Is that all the time, half the time, three quarters of the time? How much of a connection is there?
So it's a great question, and it's highly variable. So I'm going to speak mostly to opioids, because it's actually a lot harder to detect alcohol use and the effects in the newborn babies for many, many reasons. We can get to that as a separate question, perhaps, if people are interested. But when we're talking about opioids, there's a few things that are important. So if a mother is taking any kind of opioid medication, it doesn't matter the reason how or why she's taking it, it's going to have the same physiologic effects on the baby. So a baby can have physical withdrawal symptoms at birth, and we don't say that the newborns are addicted. We usually say that they're dependent because addiction's a behavior, and, you know, the newborn can't really have a behavior yet, right? But they have a physical dependence on these medications that manifest in certain symptoms that we see in the newborn period. So if a mother is taking high doses of pain medications appropriately because she has a kidney stone, that's one example. If a mother is taking heroin because she is actively abusing drugs during the pregnancy, or if a mother has had a problem with opioid addiction but is in a long-term treatment program, to maintain a safe and healthy pregnancy, she is often put on a maintenance medication like methadone or buprenorphine, and that is actually recommended for a safe and healthy pregnancy. But the babies of all three of those women can have the very same symptoms after they're born, and we manage them the same way. Of course, the family is all different in how we're working in terms of working with the mother and recovery and parenting skills, and a safe plan of discharge for the child is really different in those three situations.
So just to get the medical part right, Dr. Holmes, so even a pregnant woman who is no longer using heroin or another type of drug still needs to be on some sort of, I don't know how else to put it, maintenance protocol or withdrawal protocol. Why is that, Dr. Holmes?
So the term we use is, there's two terms, medically assisted treatment or opioid agonist therapy. Those are the two medical terms. So if someone is abusing opioids and having those highs that they get when they take a drug of abuse, they're also having periods of withdrawal. So a person who is struggling with an opioid use disorder will tell you that they're sick or they're dope sick, and they feel terrible, and they will do anything they can, not necessarily to get high again, but to get those symptoms of withdrawal, to make them go away. So if you're pregnant, the baby in utero is also experiencing withdrawal, and that's what's dangerous for the baby during pregnancy. So if the mother and the baby during the pregnancy are having periods of withdrawal, that's a risk for stillbirth, preterm delivery, or potentially even brain damage that can occur in utero. So women should, if they're having a problem with opioids, tell their obstetrics provider and get onto a maintenance medication. The maintenance medication keeps the withdrawal symptoms away and keeps you from having those highs and lows and gives the best chances of the baby going to term.
I see. So again, some level of medically assisted treatment to protect the mother and the baby. And I wonder how you approach this, Courtney Gray Tanner at Hope on Haven Hill. You want women to be in recovery, but they do need these medications to keep their babies safe.
Absolutely. So we support them. So we have moms at Hope on Haven Hill that are either on Subutex, which is a safe form of Suboxone, and that's a prescription. So we manage their medications with them in the house. Or we have moms on methadone, which in order to get a dose of methadone, you have to go to the methadone clinic. And so we take them every morning to the methadone clinic.
So you don't have methadone at your facility?
We don't. We don't. So we have to take them to the clinic every morning. But we absolutely support each of our moms in their medication-assisted treatment.
And do moms have to be sober before they can come to Hope on Haven Hill? Do you take somebody who is still actively using?
We do. And it's a process, but we do take somebody. Most of our moms that come from the streets are still in active use. So
okay.
We juggle that.
Lots more to talk about after a very short break. Again, the number for you to join us with your comments, questions, 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. We'll be right back.
It's Election Day on Tuesday. Voters in cities across New Hampshire will head to the polls to weigh in on mayoral races and other local issues. And NHPR's Morning Edition will be in Manchester throughout the morning, speaking with political analysts and newsmakers as New Hampshire's largest city chooses its next leader. Join Rick Ganley live from the Bridge Cafe on Elm Street in Manchester, or tune in to Morning Edition on Tuesday from 5 to 9 on NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, new attention, a new resource is aimed at pregnancy and opioid addiction as more babies are born with exposure to drugs. Also, by the way, we know many of you are following the story from New York City. NPR will have updates during the day and will keep you informed on that. The number for you to join our conversation right now is 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. Again, 1-800-892-6477. And Michelle Sperling, earlier you told us your amazing story. You know, grew up in a nice home with nice parents and never really got into trouble or partied a lot, and then all of a sudden one pill got you addicted on this path of opioid addiction. What made treatment finally click for you, Michelle? Because you got really low, as you told us earlier. You lost your marriage, your job, homeless, and so forth.
I was sick of living that life. I was sick of depending on a drug just to feel normal. I would literally get high and start panicking for withdrawal. Like, where am I going to get my next fix? Like, I don't want to feel like this tomorrow. So I got to the point I wasn't even enjoying my high, and I was just constantly in this miserable state where I just was always worried where my next fix was going to come from and how I was going to get it. And thank God that I didn't have the option to use when I was in jail. I don't think jail is any way for, I don't think addicts should be locked up. That's not the solution, but that's a whole different story. I'm grateful for that in my story, because had I not been confined, I would have been out getting high. So when I got to walk out of jail, I could go back to that life, or I could start a new life in recovery.
And when you walked out of jail, you told us you knew you were pregnant, right?
I did not know I was pregnant. No, that was that I got pregnant like 2 weeks after I got out of jail. And I'm really, really just grateful that all this happened, because I didn't plan on having a baby. It was not my plans whatsoever. I was in no place, but I'm extremely grateful for it now.
Just gotten out of jail, yeah. So it's not a time when a lot of people think about starting a family. How much of knowing that you were pregnant, how much did that sort of strengthen your resolve not to go back to that using path?
She's my biggest motivation. She never has to know, like, that struggle. She never has to be around that, and I'm so grateful for that. I feel for moms who don't seek treatment because they don't want, there's nothing like Hope on Haven Hill, really. We need more of it, because a lot of moms don't want to go to treatment because they can't bring their kids with them. I'm just extremely grateful that I was able to go to this treatment center pregnant, and I could stay with my baby there for a year postpartum until she's turns a year old. She was my biggest motivator, and I'm so glad that I got sober when I did. Like, she doesn't ever have to know that struggle. I'm going to be really open about it with her, because I am an addict, she's predisposed to that.
So she needs to know that.
Yes, I'm going to educate her. She's not going to know all, like, the grim details, but I am going to tell her, you know, your mom was an addict, and I did all this for myself so that I could give myself and you a better life.
You know, I wonder, picking up on what Michelle said about some women don't seek treatment even though they know they're pregnant. Courtney, do some women fear that their babies will be taken away from them if they admit that they are pregnant and addicted?
I absolutely think so. So in New Hampshire, we only have two entities, Hope on Haven Hill and Keystone Hall has a Cynthia Day program. And so because we're lacking capacity in New Hampshire, we don't have the ability to support moms as they enter into recovery. I think it's absolutely a fear that women have if they seek prenatal care or if they go to their doctors, will DCYF become involved and will I have my baby taken away?
And is that the law, Michelle Merritt? I mean, if, I know that there are concerns about parents with opioid addiction and kids being safe and, you know, some thought that those children should be put in foster care so that they're kept safe.
So the fear that Courtney articulated is not an unfounded one in New Hampshire. New Hampshire's Child Protection Act was recently modified and changed to include a provision that parental substance misuse, it creates a rebuttable or there's a rebuttable presumption of child abuse or neglect that can trigger a DCYF investigation. The bill that made that modification was passed in 2016. I think what may be less understood is that parent, and particularly by parents and providers, is that that is a rebuttable presumption. So if an individual like Michelle is engaged in a treatment program, then that prevents the investigation from really going any further with DCYF. We definitely have, I think, some issues in how ultimately that piece of legislation is being implemented and confusion among providers as to what obligations they have. But we know that women with substance use disorders are reluctant to disclose their opiate use to treatment providers for two real reasons. The first is stigma. And the second is that they have this real fear that if they have an existing child in the home, that there's going to be a mandatory report filed against them and a DCYF investigation opened, and they run the risk of potentially having their children taken away.
Does New Futures have a policy on this? Because, you know, the flip side is we have seen some children, you know, abused and two children died over recent years of abuse and neglect. So there is a heightened concern about kids being in unsafe spaces.
Yeah, that's definitely an issue. And DCYF has challenges that are very difficult for them just in general with staffing shortages, et cetera. We know, though, that I mean, it's utmost concern that this piece of legislation and how ultimately it's implemented and perceived by individuals with substance use disorder will prevent women from asking for help. And then you hear about some of those really dramatic instances of preterm labor or other birth risks that I'm sure the doctors on the line might be able to speak to a little bit more. Those are things that the public health concerns that we need to take into account. And how a piece of legislation ultimately is perceived by the public is ultimately really what matters the most, because you're going to have women not obtaining prenatal care, giving birth at home to really high-risk, high-need babies. And I don't think anyone wants that.
Well, and Dr. Holmes, I want to turn to you on that for sure. But go ahead, Michelle. I can see you want to jump in.
Yeah, I had DCYF involvement because I was on maintenance during my pregnancy.
Maintenance meaning?
On buprenorphine. And I was so scared the second I had her. About 2 days during my hospital stay, DCYF came and paid me a visit and told me that it was just protocol because I was on the Suboxone maintenance program, that they needed to, you know, do 4 minimum home visits, which went out for, I think they spaced it out over 2 months. And I was so scared for nothing. They were amazing. I gave them, I signed releases to my doctor, so they were able to get a year's worth of clean drug tests. I did it for a year longer than I even needed to. I had nothing to hide. And they came, they did a couple home visits, just making sure that she was safe and had everything she needed, food, formula, you know, just made sure I was engaging with her. And after that 4th minimum visit, they were closed my report.
Dr. Holmes, have you had to wade into this issue? You know, concern about keeping kids safe, concern about parents abusing drugs. Have you had to deal with this?
Oh, absolutely. All healthcare providers are what we call mandated reporters. So anytime that we have a sense that a child could potentially be in a dangerous situation, we are required by law to alert the child protection authorities. It doesn't mean that they necessarily do anything. And what I'd want to have the audience hear is that in cases like Michelle's, where one is in a treatment program, her experience is going to be what happens. So getting into a treatment program, and yes, they will visit you, but they really want to be there to support you. So if you're trying to get better and you're compliant with your treatment and you're working hard to be a wonderful parent like so many women are, then it's really just a check to make sure that things are going well.
Do you have concerns, Dr. Holmes, about the impression that some women might have that if they admit drug use, DCYF will take their babies away? I mean, Michelle Sperling told us she was terrified. Now, ultimately, it was a good experience, but, you know, she was scared.
I'm very concerned about that, and I'm very concerned about the risk that they might not go for prenatal care and might continue using those short-acting dangerous drugs where they can be experiencing withdrawal symptoms, which is so much more dangerous for them and for the baby.
Courtney, go ahead.
Yeah, and I think Michelle's story is a beautiful one, but it's almost a simple one because we have women both in our home and that we're serving in our outpatient services that have older children who have either been their rights have been terminated previously, so they have a standing history with DCYF. So even when moms are engaged in treatment, either at Hope on Haven Hill or other substance use providers, because they have a history of active use, that kind of is pinned against them with their DCYF case. And, you know, Michelle was very fortunate that she found her recovery, maintained her recovery before giving birth to Ellie. But we do have parents who have had children taken away before. And so these are complicated lives.
And so they're concerned that that might happen again.
Sure.
But it doesn't sound like, Courtney, you're saying that DCYF did the wrong thing in those instances. Every case is different.
Every case is different. Every case is different. So we're, you know, Hope on Haven Hill is actively working to partner with DCYF so that we can find some common ground. And this is complicated. Substance use disorders are complicated. And so we're working hard.
Let's take some calls, all of you. And again, the number 1-800-892-6477. You can send us an email to exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. One more time, the number 1-800-892-6477. Also, by the way, just want to mention that NPR is following, of course, very closely the story of this attack in New York City. And 1A will be talking about this at 10 o'clock this morning, about a half an hour from now. So NPR is on top of that story and will continue to bring it to you. Let's go to our listeners now. David is in Dover. Go ahead, David. You're on the Exchange. Welcome.
Hello. Thank
Hi.
You for
yeah, go ahead,
me.
David.
Yeah, I had a question. Is there going to be more funding for programs to help women with pregnant children that are looking to recover?
Well, and David, it's a great question. And I'll throw that to you, Michelle Merritt, because the New Hampshire Charitable Foundation just put out a very large grant aimed at this, right?
They did. And I think Courtney might be one to better speak to it because Courtney is one of the grantees.
Right.
But I can speak to a little bit about some of the things the state of New Hampshire is doing. One of the most important things from my perspective in helping and supporting these women who are going through programs that are very similar to Courtney's, that are a longer-term substance use disorder treatment facility where it's a residential setting, is ensuring that they have access to health insurance. We know that of the babies that are born with neonatal abstinence syndrome, that about 78% are born to Medicaid-eligible moms or moms that are covered through Medicaid.
Wow.
The traditional Medicaid program for pregnant women terminates 60 days postpartum. So women like Michelle would not be able to maintain Medicaid coverage and reimbursement for their treatment after that 60-day program ends, or the coverage period ends for Medicaid pregnant women Medicaid. Medicaid expansion comes in after that 60-day period and can help support the treatment. It is absolutely critical that women like Michelle, who are in really high-risk, high-need situations, particularly when they have young babies that they have access to these services. And our Medicaid expansion program is what enables many women to obtain access to these programs.
Go ahead, Courtney.
Yeah, so we, all of our women in our house and our outpatient services, so Hope on Haven Hill also serves about 30 to 40 women at the same time that we're serving our 8 women who are in the house in our outpatient services.
Oh, I see. So you have outreach
we
in the
do.
Community.
We do. So we manage our wait list, and then we also have outpatient services, counseling, and groups for women who are in the community. Michelle has since finished our program at Hope on Haven Hill and is now in our outpatient services. And all of our women, but for a couple of exceptions, are on the Medicaid expansion population. So if it weren't for that funding, we would not have our doors open.
All right. Well, David, there's your answer. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Dr. Holmes, I wanted to ask you a little bit about a study that you were involved in that often shows the best care for a baby with substance dependence is not medication, but traditional activities that many parents already do. What did you find about this? It's really interesting.
So we began our work by looking at the existing literature on neonatal abstinence syndrome. And neonatal abstinence syndrome is the medical term that we use for babies who have the physical symptoms of opioid withdrawal. So we found, and based on the past literature, found that when babies stay with their mothers or other family members in the same room after delivery and through those first few days of life when the withdrawal symptoms might rear their head, might manifest, that the babies did a lot better and they did not have as many withdrawal symptoms and you were not as likely to need medications. However, in most locations, babies are typically cared for in neonatal intensive care units where the parents can't stay with them 24/7. So we worked very hard here with my colleagues across the various departments at Dartmouth-Hitchcock, from general pediatrics to neonatology to my friends in obstetrics and midwifery, and with our psychiatry team to change our model of care to have the babies always stay with a parent or family member. And by doing that change and also changing how we as physicians reacted when they had some mild withdrawal, we were able to decrease the percentage of babies that are treated with medications from the national average of about half of them. We're down to around 20%.
Dramatic drop there. Yeah, go ahead.
Other centers have done that, have had similar results. So people are very interested in this.
Just to unpack it a little bit, so typically babies born with dependence, with what you call neonatal abstinence syndrome, that's considered a risk factor. So you would typically, Dr. Holmes, correct me if I'm wrong, put those babies in the neonatal unit.
That's what happens in most centers. They're placed in a monitored neonatal intensive care nursery.
So you want to keep an eye on them. Yeah, go ahead.
Right. And those are the places where the nursing staff and physician staff had the most experience and training in this condition. So we had to do a lot of training, both in terms of me and my physician colleagues and my nursing colleagues in the regular units, the regular nursery and the regular pediatric unit, so that we would get better at managing this syndrome. But the babies with withdrawal, though they can, you know, they can be sick, most of them do not meet the definition of critical illness.
So maybe they don't need to be in that sort of, for lack of a better word, sterile environment that you have in the neonatal mm-hmm. unit. They're better off just up against mom or dad or some other yeah. warm human being.
They like skin to skin. They like being held. They like it dark and quiet. They like to be fed frequently and doing all those things in a very calm, loving, caring place tends to help them have fewer symptoms.
All right. We will talk a lot more after a short break. Stay with us. This is The Exchange on NHPR. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today, new resources and new attention on helping pregnant women with opioid addiction and their babies. That's what we're talking about this hour. We'd love to hear from you, your questions and comments. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. By the way, we know many of you are concerned about that attack in New York yesterday. NPR is on top of that story. 1A will be covering the attack in New York City at 10 this morning. So stay with NHPR for that. We'll bring you that story as it develops. Back to our conversation about pregnant women, treating them and their babies. Courtney, it was interesting to hear Dr. Holmes talk about, you know, this sort of new old approach toward helping these babies who were born with dependence. And I wonder what your thoughts are there.
Yeah, so we see all of our moms give birth at Wentworth Douglas Hospital in Dover. And that's exactly the experience they're able to deliver at Wentworth Douglas as well. So Michelle can talk a little bit about her experience at Wentworth Douglas, but they do a wonderful job really caring for both mom and for baby during the time that mom's usually discharged a couple of days before the baby's able to go home. Babies with NAS have to stay at the hospital for at least 5 days. That's the floor. So
at that hospital, mm-hmm. do they encourage the sort of, you know, skin to skin, not in the neonatal unit, a lot of mom and other loved ones contacting with the baby?
They do. And they actually have these special rooms that are quiet and allow for the family to be with the baby during that time. And I think Michelle can speak to her experience with Ellie too.
Yeah, go ahead, Michelle.
Yeah, it is when you are on maintenance. It's an automatic 5-day stay at the hospital. I had a C-section, so I was discharged after day 3, but they still wanted to monitor Ellie. So I was there for 2 extra days with her. The neonatal unit was amazing there. It was just kid friendly, really small, like there were small dark rooms. There was no TV, but I would always put Pandora, like lullaby station on for her or something, but I was able to just bond with her in there. We just did skin to skin. All the nurses were amazing that they would, because your baby gets scored just for withdrawal symptoms, and they would go over everything with me. They would make sure I understood what was going on. They encouraged skin to skin. I was nursing. I had no idea when I had her what to do, and I knew I wanted to breastfeed, and I was really nervous about it because I'm like, well, is this safe? I'm on Subutex right now.
Oh, that's a good point, right?
It is safe. They encourage it. So they were right there along with me, right by my side, like helping her latch. I stayed with her. I didn't leave the hospital. I think I left once to go home and take a shower and get some clothes, but it was a 5-day stay, and thank God Ellie was fine. I'm really grateful. Wentworth Douglas was amazing.
I heard a huge sigh of relief too when you said she was fine. You were worried that she was going to be born with some problems.
I did. I think every mom on maintenance is worried about that. But what the interesting thing about Suboxone and methadone is, some mothers will be, you know, you can take 2 pregnant moms and both of them being on methadone or Suboxone and them being on the exact same dose, taking it the same time every day. When they finally have their babies, one mother can leave the hospital right at day 5, no withdrawal symptoms whatsoever. But the other mother her baby could be in full-on withdrawal. It varies from baby to baby, which I think is really interesting. And
We're also physiologically different.
Yeah.
It's kind of amazing. And I actually wonder about that, Dr. Holmes. So thank you for raising that point, Michelle. What about that, Dr. Holmes? Everyone is so different. And so you can't blame the docs for wanting to stay on top of it and, you know, be a little bit worried about that baby being out of their watchful eye every moment of the day.
Right. So we have some national guidelines to work with, and so the American Academy of Pediatrics has a practice guideline on watching newborns who've been exposed to opioids. So anywhere from 4 to 7 days is how long we watch any baby that's been exposed after delivery. Some babies have no withdrawal symptoms at all, even for mothers that are on relatively high doses of a maintenance medication. Some have some of these mild to moderate symptoms, and I think we're doing better at controlling those with these environmental measures. And then, as Michelle said, even a mother taking just a modest dose because of her own genetics, and then also coupled with the baby's own genetics of how he or she metabolizes the medication, could potentially have much more significant withdrawal.
You know, Dr. Holmes, reading about your study and the importance of skin to skin and, again, a low stimulus environment for these babies who were born with dependence, in a way, it kind of struck me as very obvious. I mean, babies need a lot of holding and cuddling and quiet, soothing atmospheres. So why doesn't this happen more often? Why isn't this the norm?
I think in a lot of hospitals and health systems, the structural things that have to do with how the physical space in the hospital is set up can be a barrier to changing the model of care. I think also it has to do with making sure that the medical providers, nursing staff, full team have the skills to both care physically for the baby and also very supportively care for the mother. We've been really trying hard to not just improve our own care in New Hampshire, but I have wonderful colleagues here at Dartmouth-Hitchcock across the departments, and so we have been able to help with a regional network so that places across the state where babies are born are collaborating and working together to get to these more family-centered models of care.
And are those models more expensive, Dr. Holmes? You know, longer stays in the hospital, quiet separate rooms, does that cost more money?
It actually costs significantly less money to care for a baby in that way. And when we don't use medications, that usually significantly shortens the length of stay in the hospital. Neonatal intensive care bed spaces are very expensive because of how they are built and monitored and staffed. So if we don't need to use that type of resource for a baby who's at risk for withdrawal, that's a good use of healthcare resources for our population. It lets us keep those critical care beds open for babies that are premature or very sick at delivery or have congenital anomalies that need surgery. So we also feel that in addition to taking care of the opioid exposed baby population in a way that's better for their care, we're also being good with our care resources regionally.
Michelle Merrick, go ahead.
So I just wanted to add that we actually have some information on the cost for a birth of a baby that's born experiencing withdrawal symptoms or has neonatal abstinence syndrome. And on average, based on 2015 claims data, each birth roughly costs about $33,700. If you compare that to births to babies that are not born experiencing these symptoms, it's around $7,800. There's a significant difference in the cost for having a baby that's experiencing these withdrawal symptoms. And I also just wanted to mention and pick up on something that Michelle said, is that this really is not an issue that we can deal with in isolation. We need to look at the systems that we have as a state both before and after a birth. So in before, ensuring that we have access to prenatal care. Some of that coverage is through Medicaid expansion, which is, again, so critical. I can't stress that enough. And then after, ensuring that we have supports in the home, whether it's through home visiting programs, of which New Hampshire has a few options available, and recovery support services, which I'm sure Michelle has accessed in her region. But just going back to the home visiting services, I have to mention it a little bit in the context of Medicaid, is that one of the things and policy priorities that New Futures is going to be working on this upcoming year is in the context of Medicaid for home visiting. The eligibility criteria are extremely narrow to receiving these services. So just to back up a second, what home visiting services are, they are supportive services that go into the home of at-risk families. They provide education, supports, access to community resources, ensuring the health and wellness of both the baby and the mom, providing parenting skills, family resources, et cetera. In New Hampshire, our Medicaid program restricts eligibility to women who are under the age of 21, who are giving birth to their first baby, and they have to access and engage in treatment services or within these home visiting services within 2 weeks of giving birth. You have
Wow. It's hard to clear your mind and do anything 2 weeks having had two kids. I mean, you're still kind of in a fog. I mean, I'm not sure how you would go around doing that.
And for women that are giving birth to babies that are really high need, and in many cases they're over the age of 21 when you have a substance use disorder and are giving birth, this is the population that needs these services the most. And if you have a baby that has been in a hospital for upwards of 13, I think the average is around 18 days for a baby that's born with neonatal abstinence syndrome, these women miss that period of engaging in these really valuable services that could benefit countless women. So one of the policy priorities that New Futures is putting forward this year, in addition to continuing to reauthorize Medicaid expansion, is broadening those eligibility criteria to allow women like Michelle to have access to those services in home that they currently wouldn't have access to.
Did you want to jump in, Michelle?
Actually, I do. My Medicaid was actually cut off a week after I had my daughter. My due date was June 11th, and they had scheduled a face-to-face while I was in the hospital. So I didn't get to make it to that face-to-face meeting, and I went to my doctor's for my two-week postpartum checkup and found out I had no insurance. So they did reinstate it, but I could see what Michelle said, how that would come into play. They were really quick to shut my insurance off.
Let's take another call, all of you. And this is Deborah in Concord. Hi, Deborah. Go ahead. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hi. Thanks so much. I'm calling from the New Hampshire Charitable Foundation. Wanted to be sure to help answer the question that the caller had. And as you teed off this very important conversation, indicated that we have been extremely grateful to receive support from an anonymous donor to address these very critical issues that the panelists today are discussing, and to assist folks like Dartmouth Hitchcock and Hope on Haven Hill and other treatment providers to braid in philanthropic support. We always know that public support is a critical piece of this. Medicaid expansion and other forms of public support that have been discussed for medication-assisted treatment and for recovery supports and so on. But we're extremely gratified to be able to partner with these wonderful providers who are working to help women to be in recovery and to help ensure that their infants can have the healthiest possible path going forward. So just wanted to share that and to continue to encourage folks who are involved in this important work to be in dialogue with us so that we can identify in an ongoing way. This is a three-year commitment. So this year, 2018, 2019, we can continue to identify the ways that philanthropic support can help to move this very important work forward.
Okay. Deborah, thank you for calling in. Go ahead, Courtney.
And Hope on Haven Hill is so grateful to have received a $25,000 match grant from that $3 million gift to the Charitable Foundation. And so as soon as Hope on Haven Hill raises the additional $25,000, another $25,000 will be released to us. So, we're so grateful to have received a grant from this gift, too.
Again, the number for you to join us is 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Just to wrap up with all of you, and you first, Dr. Holmes, what's next for you and your work at Dartmouth Hitchcock, including that research that you've been doing on newborns exposed to opioids during pregnancy? What more would you like to know? What more would you like to do?
There's a lot more that we'd like to know. I first also wanted to thank the New Hampshire Charitable Foundation for the portion of that grant from the anonymous donor that will come to us.
which is going to go to expand our comprehensive multi-specialty, multidisciplinary services that serve mothers in the Upper Valley before, during, and after pregnancy. So we have a perinatal addiction treatment program. It has been outpatient only. This will allow us to very soon expand to what's called an intensive outpatient for folks who need more support. And eventually we would really like to be able to have a residential program in this region.
So again, this means, and just to jump in, using some medical language there, so that means pregnant moms out in the community. You would like to reach out to them more? Is that what you mean?
Well, we have a program that is an outpatient program that's a partnership between obstetrics, psychiatry, and pediatrics. We'd like to be able to offer a residential program like Hope on Haven Hill where mothers can stay with their babies when they need more than an outpatient program. The grant is letting us to expand our outpatient program to provide more hours of services. But eventually we would like to have a place where people can stay for a while too when they need that kind of support.
Wow, coordination between three different disciplines but overlapping towards this one common goal. That's really interesting. Yeah.
And in terms of the research on what goes on for the newborn hospital stay, we would really like to start to look at if the things that we can do differently in the hospital have any type of long-term outcomes. So looking at if a baby spends time in a neonatal intensive care unit versus in a rooming-in environment, gets treated with medication or not treated with medication, does that have any impact on that baby's eventual developmental outcomes?
Well, I was going to ask you about that, Dr. Holmes, and maybe that's a subject for another show. But yeah, what do we know about the success of these babies as they become kids? And depending on what happened to them in those very, very early days, what do we see in the years on out? So that sounds like a topic for another show and more research for you to do, Dr. Holmes. How about you, Michelle Merritt? What do you hope happens from here on out?
So I think from a policy perspective, I know I've mentioned Medicaid expansion a few times, and again, it's because I can't stress enough how critically important this program is to individuals with substance use disorder in New Hampshire. The statewide average for individuals suffering with addiction is about 10%, and among the Medicaid population, it's twice that. It is absolutely essential that we reauthorize that program this year in order to continue to provide access to these critical services going forward. And then the last thing that I would just say is encouraging legislators to fully fund our state alcohol fund, which at 5%, which has not happened yet. That is a fund that's dedicated to providing prevention, treatment, and recovery supports to individuals suffering with addiction and has the flexibility to be used to support recovery support programs for pregnant women as well as their treatment.
Okay, so Dr. Holmes and Michelle Merritt, I want to thank you, and also Courtney Gray Tanner and Michelle Sperling. Thank you also for being here, especially Michelle Sperling, for sharing your story.
You're welcome.
Really appreciate it. Thank you. Thanks everyone for being with us. This is The Exchange on NHPR, and coming up 1A, we'll be covering that terrorist attack in New York City at 10 this morning. So keep it right here. This is NHPR.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you liked what you heard, spread the word. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts to help other listeners find us. And thanks.